That idea of shrinking, you know, the space between what are my options and what's the right action for me to take, and more importantly, really giving a leader confidence, I thought was the most critical thing that we could do at Digital Capability.
Today on the Daily Scoop podcast from the Scoop News Group, inside the work of the Air Force Research Lab's Digital Capabilities Directorate a year after its creation, and how CIO Alexis Bonnell is thinking about the adoption of AI. It's Thursday, March 21st, 2024. Welcome to the Daily Scoop podcast, where you'll hear the latest news and trends facing government leaders. I'm the host of the Daily Scoop podcast, Billy Mitchell. Here's what's happening now. DHS Chief AI Officer Eric Heisen spoke this week about the department's adoption of AI. While DHS has made strong strides creating a foundation for adopting AI, Heisen said that the department faces a big cultural challenge in being responsible and transparent in using AI because some elements of DHS aren't used to operating in such a manner. Heisen said during an event hosted by CrowdStrike that transparency and responsible use of AI are critical to get right, especially for applications in law enforcement and national security settings, where the permission structure in the public eye faces a much higher bar. While President Joe Biden's AI executive order gave DHS many roles in leading the development of safety and security in the nation's use of AI applications, internally, Heisen said, the department is focused on things like using AI for cybersecurity, keeping fentanyl and other drugs out of the country, and assisting law enforcement officers and investigators in investigating crimes while making sure that's all done responsibly, safely, and securely. Heisen's comments came a day after DHS on Monday published its first AI roadmap, spelling out the agency's current use of the technology and its plans for the future. In other news, Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg announced Thursday that the agency is launching a privacy review of the country's top airlines. While the Department of Transportation isn't typically associated with investigations into digital rights violations, the agency says it has the authority to impose civil penalties involving unfair and deceptive practices involving passenger information. Airlines can access several forms of personal information about passengers, including through apps, online purchases, software used by flight attendants, and increasingly biometric screening systems. The privacy review comes amid a collaboration with Senator Ron Wyden's office and is supposed to be the first of many. This round will apply to Allegiant, Alaska, American, Delta, Frontier, Hawaiian, JetBlue, Southwest, Spirit, and United Airlines, which have already received letters from the agency. The investigation will be led by the agency's Office of Aviation Consumer Protection and cover personal information policies, privacy training within the airlines, and complaints about airline privacy violations. You can read more about these stories and much more at fedscoop.com. The Air Force Research Lab last March established its Digital Capabilities Directorate to speed up its modernization pursuits and enable its scientists and engineers to explore and more efficiently collaborate via a growing suite of emerging technologies. The directorate fuses together former AFRL elements like its Research Collaboration and Computing Directorate, as well as the lab's former Business Process Reengineering Division and others. It also has roots that trace back to a temporary digital war room that was stood up to help drive innovation at the lab. Alexis Bonnell is Air Force Research Lab CIO and Director of the Digital Capabilities Directorate, appointed to those roles last July. She joins the podcast to discuss her journey to the role, her priorities nearly a year in, and how things are shifting as AI becomes an increasingly important part of AFRL's enterprise IT. Alexis, welcome to the Daily Scoop podcast. Thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, thanks so much for having me, Billy. It's great to be here.
Yeah, it's good to catch up with you again. And, you know, it's been a while since we last spoke. And I think at that time you were in the private sector. So now you are the CIO of the Air Force Research Lab, which is an incredible role and a nice reentry into the government space. So congratulations.
Thanks. Yeah, it's about the best reentry that anyone who functions with a kind of bias to action and pretty heavy level of curiosity can hope to get. So it's a real honor to be here.
Well, that's great. And it's been about a year, and let's not pretend it's like something that just happened yesterday or even this year. But I do want to spend a bit of time talking to you about that new role and sort of your journey to back into government, as we've been kind of talking about. So let's start there. You know, you've spent a lot of time in government, went to the private sector, and now you're back. So tell me about your journey into this new role and sort of what some of your big focuses and how you came to be the CIO of AFRL.
Yeah, I think sometimes what's really interesting about our journeys is that they can feel very disjointed. And then all of a sudden you can be like, oh, now I understand why I needed all of those components. And so this, you know, coming to AFRL where I get to serve both Air Force and Space Force feels a lot of like the puzzle pieces fitting together. So, you know, to back up way back in the 90s, my first job was really helping organizations navigate bricks to clicks, right? What does it look like? What is all this internet stuff? I remember even walking into, you know, organizations like American Express and being like, this thing, the internet, is going to change how you do business, right? And at the time, it was like, yeah, we think it's a fad. We think it's not going to stick. And so, you know, I think for me, cutting my teeth really in this idea of how you help people and organizations change, right, and adapt, and especially when it comes to, you know, relationships with technology. So starting there, I kind of cut my teeth, right, in this idea of how should technology really, you know, enable us to be the best organizations or people or mission. You know, I then got to spend a bunch of time in war zones, and so really be up close and personal and deliver a lot of DoD programming and have an incredible, you know, amount of respect for the warfighter and serve, you know, with many of them while I was in a UN capacity at the time, really being in places like Afghanistan and Iraq. And I think that was really important to kind of drive home what that feels like, right? What it's like. And quite frankly, you know, sometimes technology is crap, right? It doesn't meet what you need, and being able to be realistic and really have that kind of warfighter centric, you know, mentality, I think was a real gift. Then coming over to USAID, you know, that was really my first federal job, and being able to look at business transformation, but even more importantly, being able to serve as one of the co-founders of the Global Development Lab, which was at the time USAID's approach to kind of innovation, science, and technology. So, and start a lab, right? And then finally, you know, doing my last kind of 3 years at Google and as the emerging technology evangelist was, again, kind of coming home and saying, hey, tech is changing, cloud, APIs, AI, like there's something in it for everyone. So I think, you know, coming to the Air Force Research Lab just feels like every single one of those things matter. And I think particularly what excites me the most is that technology really has fundamentally changed in the last 3 years, our attitude toward it, our expectations of it. And so being at a place that already has to be forward-leaning, but, you know, really has to do that in a way that supports kind of both science and the warfighter was an incredible opportunity to kind of bring that all full circle.
And there's a lot of incredible work being done at the Air Force Research Lab that I'm sure we'll get into. But, you know, to start with, you know, as the CIO now for almost a year, I'd love to hear about what some of your priorities are. I'm sure in some sense you're still, you know, figuring that out. I mean, a year is not a lot of time, but I'm sure you have learned a lot and have come away with some pretty concrete steps to take forward. So what does, you know, your role look like today and what you're focusing on and how are you going to progress into the future?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, don't date me, Billy. It's only been about 7 months, but yes, we're coming up on the home stretch, you know. But definitely long enough for me to, you know, to really develop an incredible sense of you know, of respect for what, you know, the organization had done previously and where we're going. I think one of the things that's interesting to call out is, you know, my approximation is that the role of CIO is actually really changing, right? So, you know, if you were going to ask me 3 years ago, 5 years ago, you know, that role was often in organizations looked at as kind of, hey, make sure the email works, don't get hacked, you know, kind of some of the basic administration, kind of spinal cord work. I think now, especially after COVID and with the technologies that are coming out, you really have a kind of new opportunity as a CIO to say, and this is the approach that I take, is really, who do we want to be as an organization? How do we want our people to tick? What do we want the behaviors and values for them to exercise? And how does technology play a role into that, right? So a lot of folks are surprised that I don't come in talking about platforms or apps or tools or systems. I really sit and say, you know, who do you want to be? How do you want to be more curious? You know, what's the feeling that someone wants to have? And most importantly, my anchor question is really, what's the relationship with knowledge, right, that we want to have. And so I think when you start from there, it makes it a lot easier to understand. And quite frankly, I think you pick better technologies, right, that meet the culture or meet the way you want to exercise that. So for me, part of that process over the last year or 7 months was a few. I think the first was, and some of these things aren't necessarily that sexy, right, but they actually really matter. And so the first one was efforts around what we call the digital catalog, but it's really, what are we already doing, right? What do we already have? What tools, technologies? I think it's really hard to say where you should go and what you should, if you don't know where you're starting, right? And so the digital catalog was a lot about kind of honoring the past, understanding the current, what are we using? And quite frankly, are people happy with it? And so we're in that process right now to really say, okay, what are my 9 cloud options, right? Or what are the apps that are already provided? And sometimes while, again, this isn't sexy. I think what it also does is really lays a foundation to understand why you have particular tools. So as an example, you may have 2 tools that at a leadership or at a top level kind of look the same, but when you get down below them, you know, maybe one requires a CAC and one doesn't, or one can be used with allies and one can't, or other things. And those are actually really critical, different, you know, mission imperatives. And so, you know, I think while I'm a big fan of consolidating where we can, I'm also a big fan of really understanding, why does this exist? Because in government, let's be realistic, it's not always that easy just to create something, right? Sure. And so I really start with the idea that even if it's, you know, become a bit of a legacy system or isn't, you know, something that everyone is in love with, there's really a reason why it exists, right? And so the first is, what is that reason? What is that information or relationship with knowledge? So that digital catalog, I think, will give us, you know, our customers and our partners a better understanding of where we're starting. I think it also means that it lays the foundation for us to understand what we haven't yet used, right? So being kind of an on-ramp for, you know, commercial COTS or GOTS tools, especially, you know, some of the smaller providers, and really kind of creating a foundation so that when we want to do something, we know all the options that we have. The second one, and this is probably the most important, was, you know, in my time with Google, one of the things I loved the most was just like being a friend or an ally to government or DoD leaders to say, like, what are you trying to do? Right? Like, how do we help you pull this off? And I think people really underestimate, you know, being a government leader, you don't have a lot of bandwidth, you're super busy, you're getting tons of pressure all the time, right, to do something different or unique. And quite frankly, it can be a little anxiety creating around technology to say, well, I've heard of this tool, or I got briefed on this tool. But that idea of shrinking, you know, the space between what are my options and what's the right action for me to take, and more importantly, really giving a leader confidence, I thought was the most critical thing that we could do at Digital Capabilities. And so, you know, we brought in some folks and really created time to just go sit with the customer and the leader and talk about, what is that relationship with knowledge? What would, you know, what would it be? What would be amazing 6 months from now for you to be able to do? And it wasn't so much that we needed to make technology decisions for them. We just needed to kind of give them a friend to say, hey, here's 6 options. Here's what's great about them. Here's what's challenging. You know, which one kind of seems like the right fit. And, you know, I think in federal government, we often have, you know, like 18F or digital services or things like that. In DoD, we don't really have as much of that, right, or as much capacity. So I think, you know, stepping back and recognizing, it's not my job to always be the smartest technologist. It's my job to, in essence, help people understand what their options are and let them get excited about the tools and the services. You know, another one for us, I think, is, though, really understanding what are our enterprise options, right? The Department of the Air Force have done kind of huge work around different enterprise tools, and they're great tools that do particular things really well. And so we need to kind of start to use those to take advantage of that. I think another one is just generally API first, right? How do we get the right info at the right time? We don't necessarily, I think, need to be creating the same level of big ERP systems. So that's been a real priority. And I think the final one is really thinking about who needs to understand technology and who doesn't. What I mean by that is, it's hard and exhausting to learn a new tool, right? To learn a new, you know, a new app. And I think sometimes we can say, oh, it's just 5 minutes, it's just an hour. It's just a, you know, it's just these things. And I'd rather have people not have to learn tools. I'd rather have the scientists be able to do great science. And so, you know, we step back and it's really, well, then what does data as a service look like, right? Or what does compute or security as a service? How do we make that RMF process maybe less painful, you know, for folks? So it's really about giving time back. And of course, when we look at future things, we're already really neck deep in a huge amount of kind of AI projects and other things that we're really excited about as well. So those, you know, just a few priorities, but, you know, luckily I've got a great team who are doing incredible work. And, you know, quite frankly, each of our labs also has technologists. And so I don't have to go in a dark room and come up with it. Half the time they've solved it. It's just yeah. No one knows they've solved it, right? So really being that, you know, serving as a connective tissue across the brilliance that exists in our organization.
Yeah, well, that sounds ideal and like a really opportune sort of role to be in. So that's cool to hear. And, you know, you mentioned digital capabilities a number of times. And, you know, there's the semi-new digital capabilities directorate within the lab. So I'm curious, you know, how much does that sort of overlap into what you're saying? Or is that like a completely different sort of mechanism? Tell me more, I guess, to put it, you know, pretty plainly about the directorate and how you see your role as the director of that, because that's also a part of your job as well.
Yeah, and that's actually interesting because I had a really terrifying realization the other day, Billy, and that was, okay, so I'm the CIO, so I own elements of, you know, the IT and technology strategy for AFRL. I'm also the head of digital capabilities, which means I have a budget and people, right, to be executing mm-hmm. and to make good on that strategy. And then the final one most recently is I've taken over as our authorizing official. So if you think about it, I really don't have anyone else to blame but myself if we don't make progress, right? In the sense that, okay, I, you know, I can have a vision with the team and with our incredible leaders. I can at least roll up my sleeves, right, a little bit along with, you know, with our team and start making some progress on that. Most importantly, you know, I can understand what's coming down the pipe that, you know, we might be asked to authorize. Yeah. And so, you know, I think with DCD in particular, though, you know, it's really, you know, kind of four things. And we try to keep them very straightforward, very human. You know, the first is our goal is to reduce toil, right? So it is not just 5 minutes or three extra forms or what have you, you know, or an extra training to me. It's, I really see time as a weapons platform in itself. And so, you know, if time is a weapons platform, then to me, a minute is as important as a missile, right? And yeah. So making sure, again, that scientist gets to stay on bench doing the incredible work. And I think, you know, one of the things I've really learned, Billy, is that, you know, toil eats purpose faster than mission can rebuild it. And so I think a lot of times we really underestimate the toll it takes on our people, you know, to have to navigate those things that, you know, that are often perceived as less valuable or bureaucratic or administrative. So that reducing toil is one. You know, the second is actually making better, faster decisions. You know, we're talking about a time now where a leader is going to be asked and asking questions that just weren't even on the game board 2 years ago, right? And being asked to think about them with a volume of information that is historically unprecedented, right? I mean, for some of us, we're going from, you know, I like to call it kind of, you know, drips to deluges. So it might be the type of thing where I'm expected to navigate 1,000 times more information, right, to make a decision than I was only 3 years ago. So that idea of faster, you know, more confidence-rich decisions. Another is transitioning things at scale, right? So when we discover something at AFRL, the goal is really to get it out to the warfighter, right, or the program. And yeah. So let's figure out how we do that easy, right? If we know, for example, that program is working in a particular vendor, then let's start by working in that particular, you know, vendor suite so that it can be an easy transition. And I would say the final one and probably the most pivotal is discover faster, right? So a lot of times people think, you know, discovery is like someone in a dark room that says, aha, like, but that's mm-hmm. not how it works, right? It's a contact sport. And that means that being able to have technology that allows us to collaborate or be curious and to do all of those things, you know, to faster, richer speed is really what digital capabilities, the digital capability directorate exists for. And I would say that there's a very specific reason it's called digital capabilities and not digital transformation. And what I mean by that is, you know, sometimes transformation kind of implies that there is an endpoint, right? Like we've transformed, it's done. Mm-hmm. And I think the biggest thing that we recognize now is, you know, what we're trying to do is get out of the business, if you will, of kind of building time capsules, right? That reflect a particular moment of technology or talent or legislation, and really get into building change engines, right? So that our leaders now and the ones that will come next can have that kind of adaptability that they need. And so, you know, that's one of the reasons why we think of it as an ongoing capability journey, right? And not a destination.
And I think one of the things you said that really stuck out to me was the scale. Obviously, AFRL is a part of the larger department, the Air Force. And you said earlier on, you work with Air Force and Space Force. How do you work with the other sort of CIOs or IT officials at those branches or those pieces of the department to make sure that the work that's happening at AFRL can scale?
Yeah, I think this is actually one of the best parts of the job, right, is that you're not doing it alone. There are a ton of other leaders engaged and leaning in. We were actually lucky enough just a few weeks ago to host Mrs. Goodwine, you know, the Air Force CIO out and be able to show her some of our high performance compute and modeling and sim and other types of things that we're doing. So in addition to that, you know, part of what I'm doing right now as a new AO is meeting other AOs, right, and saying, hey, how do you do this job really well? And, you know, again, having time with Mr. Bishop and others to figure out what this looks like. You know, we've gotten to work a lot with CDAO or types of other groups that are really leaning into some of the new technology. But, you know, I think the most interesting one for me, I just got back from, you know, Albuquerque, where I got to meet all of the CITOs from across the lab. And let me tell you, Billy, like some of them, you know, when you're doing discovery, when you're trying to lean in, you know, sometimes they'll really find an incredible, for example, multi-domain security solution, right? Because they have mm-hmm. to, because that's part of what their mission has to do. And so I've been so impressed by the incredible leadership all the way around. But, you know, someone asked me once, you know, oh, do you ever suffer from imposter syndrome? And my response is actually, I think imposter syndrome is my greatest strength, right? Because at a place like Air Force or Space Force, we don't have to be the smartest in the room. And in fact, if you think you are, you're probably leaving a lot of opportunity or solutions or talent on the table. And so I think, you know, one of the most fun parts of the job is to be able to sit back and be like, huh, this is a really interesting challenge. You know, I wonder if someone solved it or done it, and kind of build a coalition, you know, around that. But I think long story short, there's not enough time in the day. So anyone I haven't met out there that I should be solving with, I hope they hear this and reach out.
That's awesome. That's awesome. And kudos to you for recognizing there's other smart people out there and that you don't have to do everything. I think, you know, sometimes that sort of ego can get in the way for a leader. So.
Well, and to your point too, with that, change is just happening too fast, right? I mean, there's not enough hours in the day to understand what's emerging with technology, what's changing, our adversarial, you know, the adversary is changing at light speed as well. And so, you know, I think you really have to look at this and say, okay, I can't know everything, but what I can do is surround myself with a bunch of really smart people asking really great questions, right? And everything's kind of figure outable. We'll get it from there.
Yeah. You've mentioned a bunch during the conversation already how much things are just changing in the IT and CIO space. And obviously AI and emerging technologies are a big part of that. And you've spent a big part of your career focused on those things. So I'd love to hear how the lab is thinking about adopting emerging technologies like AI to support its operations and mission.
Yeah, I think one of the things that is a really interesting anchor for me when I think about AI, the first is I wish it was called like augmented intelligence instead of artificial, because I think sometimes even those definitions are really getting in the way of the conversation. But you know, again, if time is a weapons platform, and we've got to kind of take advantage of every minute at scale, and if we're going to be infused, for example, with more information than we ever have historically, and if we're going to be expected to make decisions at scale, then the reality, Billy, is I need a super processor, right? I need kind of an ally, you know, in the corner helping me work through all of that information and you know, exercise my curiosity and the best, you know, and my expertise and my experience. So, you know, I think AI is something that we're looking at literally every part of our work, because every part of our work has to go faster and be richer with more knowledge, you know, in less time. And so, you know, as we look at AI, I think the first and foremost is that we look at AI as a fundamental change to our relationship with knowledge, right? And especially because when we think about generative AI models, you're talking about a whole new level of kind of table stakes information. Right. And so I think, you know, what we're seeing is that instead of assuming that you have to go in a corner and start a creative or creation process, well, let's actually start with what's already exists and then build on top of it. Right. And in a lot of the work and research that we've been doing, you know, we often find that groups can actually, with good querying, with good use of AI, can get about 85% of what they would have normally done, you know, in the same period of time, done in the first day, and then really spend that time to build on top of it. And so we're just trying to encourage people to say, you know, what's that relationship with knowledge you want, right? What are the tools you have? And how do we lean in and be curious? And I think, you know, the biggest part when we think about national security is we really have to ask and answer the question, what if, faster than the adversary, right? And that means we can't spend a lot of time reinventing knowledge we already cumulatively have. And so being able to look to AI to say, okay, you can at least give me the table stakes. I can decide whether I like it, whether I think it's accurate, right? But that curation is really what, you know, what we as humans with expertise are good at. And so thinking about how I do that at scale is one of the ways we look at AI.
And just as a quick follow-up is that, you know, again, back to our last question on how you work with the other CIOs, is that something you're working in partnership with them to determine how to take step forwards? Because I know a lot of agencies across federal government are kind of awash when it comes to stepping forward with AI. They're kind of hesitant about it, but it sounds like you're bullish about it. So is that something you're talking with Ms. Goodwine and others to kind of determine the steps forward?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, to me, again, when you start to define AI as a relationship with knowledge at scale, I think it starts to change the conversation, right? Because who amongst us is going to say, no, I don't want any knowledge. No, I don't need to have that, right? And unfortunately, I think a lot of it has been focused on a tool or on a technology, but really it's what's the way we want to navigate knowledge. And so, you know, to that point, we have a whole number of kind of examples, experiments, you know, things that we've done, everything from the operational construct all the way just to the business side. I mean, quite frankly, you know, do I need to spend 45 minutes in a training, you know, or 4 days in a training when I can ask, you know, that question, you know, related in a chat bot or a digital assistant. And so, you know, I think with this, there are lots of good conversations. I think there's lots of ways that AI is a great example of how we have to navigate kind of our human identity, right, and the technology at the same time, because most of the things that come up with AI, whether that's about bias or trust, et cetera, those are actually inherently human, you know, kind of culture and value issues. And so I think it's really interesting when we start looking at these new tools to say, well, how do we navigate that really well and with intention? You know, there's even an irony right now. I was talking to one of my teams that there's so much AI writ large in government and DOD and across the world. There's so much AI regulation and best practices and other things coming out that, you know, I asked my team to create an AI that actually navigated AI regulation.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's really hard, right? As a government, you know, official or a DOD leader, you don't want to misstep, right? And there's, you know, there are new regulations and everything coming out every day. And I think sometimes we don't recognize that that is really paralyzing, right? You know, and it's especially as that changes. So I'm not kidding. I'm literally like, how can I have an AI that helps me navigate AI, you know, regulation? And, you know, that's because I want to do the right thing, but I can't, you know, I can't be expected to be an expert on the 18 regs that came out just yesterday and the 10 more that are going to come out tomorrow. So it's really interesting when we think about how we can ironically leverage some of these technologies.
Absolutely. And I think that's brilliant. Definitely interesting to hear. In a topic of another emerging technology, you know, I'd love to talk about the Research Lab supercomputer Radar. Obviously, there's a lot going on in the space around supercomputing, quantum, and what's coming there next. So I'd love to hear, you know, how that falls under your portfolio, whether it's just, you know, from a, I honestly am not super familiar with what the CIO does with that. So is it just supporting it and things like that? And how are you thinking about post-quantum encryption, which is another one of those topics that will be here before you know it?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the best elements of being at the Air Force Research Lab, right? As we have teams working on all of those things. And so I think, you know, the first from the idea of, you know, the incredible value I think it is to be able to have supercompute right within, you know, within our walls and to be able to touch that. And, you know, to break it down at a human level, a lot of times people don't understand why supercompute matters. But if we go back to that question of being able to run a lot of scenarios, right, or ask what if you think about it right now as a person, I can probably run, if I was playing chess, I could probably run like 4, maybe 10 options at a time on the chessboard, right? And I would say the average, you know, computer, maybe they can do, you know, 50, right? And you know, in supercompute, you're talking about, you know, thousands, hundreds of thousands of models, millions of models in a very short time. And if you think about it, if, you know, I really, especially when we're thinking about national security, I would much rather have those odds, right? I'd much rather kind of have someone's like, well, I ran a million scenarios and here's what might look best. Yeah. And so, you know, I think we really underappreciate compute. And one of the things that I think has happened over the past couple of years is that cloud and compute and things like that kind of started to become commodities. And I actually really don't think they are. I actually think that when you look at what we're seeing, you know, across cloud, across kind of supercompute, quantum, TPUs, you know, and other things, these are actually going to be really strategic differences, right? And yeah. So having that option, you know, when a scientist comes to me or a partner comes to me and says, you know, hey, here's what I'm trying to figure out. Here's the speed I need to figure out. And, you know, if we can shave, and this has happened for us, you know, Billy, we've shaved a year, 16 months off of a discovery process, or for example, getting a rocket in the air. And that's real time, right? I mean, if we can get incredible. A rocket up, you know, 15 months earlier, simply because we could go through, you know, the compute and calculations to make the best decision. You know, I think another thing people don't really think about is the more we can lean into modeling and simulation or artificial intelligence to help us with those simulations, it also means that we actually discover things that aren't worth our time and money faster, right? That may have taken us a long time to figure out, oh, that was the wrong road to go down, or, oh, you know, our assumptions didn't play out there. And so being able, you know, to ask what if faster isn't only about what you do keep doing, it's about what you choose to not do as well, and you know, remove or rededicate resources in another direction. And I think those are the types of things that often aren't talked about, but are so critical when we think about, you know, the modeling and sim and other capacities and how that's going to play into our national security in the future.
And then post-quantum encryption, is that something that you're at all involved in or thinking about, focused on in the future?
Yeah, I mean, I would definitely defer to my good friend Michael up in Rome and his quantum team on this in particular. But I think, you know, when we think about the application of quantum encryption and security is probably the most near case, right, element of where we're going to see real value and practicalities. And again, I'm lucky enough that we have a team that really looks at this full time and is kind of able to tell us, you know, that there's a there, if you will, right? Here's something for us to look into. But I do think on the security side, that's going to be the, you know, one of the emergent elements.
So let's close out, you know, with a very broad question. You know, something I like to ask people, and you can ask this in many shapes and forms. I usually say, what keeps you up at night? But also, you know, what gives you a headache? What are you thinking about? And what's kind of maybe driving you nuts at this moment? As we talked about all these different things, what's the thing you're most concerned with as we close this conversation out?
Yeah, I think there's two. I think the first is, you know, as we move even quicker in the digital realm, that need to be able to say, how are we securing this, right? How are we doing all of the needful things to, you know, issue an ATO or to do that type of process? I'm really intrigued by how we might bring that question of security, like to the very initial inception point, right? Right now, what happens right now is a lot of people say, hey, I've got this opportunity or this challenge. And then they do so much work, you know, picking partners and creating certain things. And then finally it comes, you know, to me as an AO. And I would actually love, you know, and quite frankly, a lot of times that process might feel like a little bit of a punch in the face at the end, right? Now I've got to do all this paperwork. I've got to do all these things. And what I'd really love to do, much like the digital ally model, is move that much earlier, right? My hypothesis is that if we can sit with folks early on in that kind of, you know, imagination, you know, art of the possible space, we can actually solve, you know, for a lot of those security things that pop up later. And I think we can be more confident about things getting through that process and getting through safely. So I'm really excited about maybe, you know, contributing to the conversation being less about the end state and more about how we actually bring that forward as a service and as almost like a concierge, you know, type of approach. The second one is probably about AI, right? I think there's a lot of folks who, you know, I'll give you a couple examples. There's a, you know, conversation, a lot of conversation around trust. And I think it's really interesting, you know, at a time where, unfortunately, people maybe trust government than we'd like them to, trust media, don't trust each other, certainly don't trust someone of, you know, different political party, may not trust their neighbor. And yet we're looking to a technology to be perfectly trustworthy, right? So it's kind of like, that's weird. And I think what really is important is that actually we understand that, you know, AI is, you know, is not magic. It's math. It's really great math at really high speed, but it's also something like any technology where it does what we want it to do, what we direct it to do with the information we direct it on. And so I think that it's really important to me that people don't actually absolve themselves, if you will, by saying, is the AI trustworthy? It's really like, are you trustworthy? Are mm-hmm. you doing the right things, right, with these technologies and with the information? And I think, you know, the more we can bring it back to that kind of level of humanity, you know, the better. I think the last thing that I would observe is, you know, sometimes in the middle of something, it's really hard, especially in a big societal change or technology change, it's actually really hard to give ourselves credit for where we are asking the right questions and doing the right thing. And I'll give you an example. You know, when the automobile was invented for about 20 years, right? There was a discourse about, is this a horrible tool of the rich that's dirty and killing people, right? Mm-hmm. Or is this something that's going to change, you know, humanity? But from, you know, the kind of the day the car was invented, I think it was about 60 years before we introduced a seatbelt, right? Like, and so yeah. If you think about it, right? I think when we look at these emerging technologies and there's the scale and impact they have on humanity, you know, to go from, you know, for example, a technology like AI becoming, you know, more mainstream, more accessible, and how quickly we really raise like, oh, bias is a problem. Like, we got to address that, right? I mean, it wasn't 60 years, it was like 6 months, right? And so I think, and you saw things like camera lenses change, right? To be able to capture, you know, more different shades of pigment and melanin in our skin. So I think sometimes these are really, really important, you know, issues that we've got to solve. And I think being, you know, being vocal, but also not ignoring when actually we do make progress and not ignoring that we're doing that pretty quickly as a society, and actually just take a hot second and say, well, that's pretty impressive actually. And I think, you know, my hope and my belief is we'll continue to do that really well.
Yeah, I think that's a fantastic point. If we want to make progress and continue on that path, I think we've got to, you know, congratulate the people who are doing the right thing and incentivize them to continue making those right decisions. So that's a fantastic point. Alexis, you know, this has been a fantastic conversation. You know, lots of insights from how you are adjusting to the new role and sort of your path with emerging technologies and everything in between. So I really appreciate your time and hope we can do it again soon.
Awesome. Well, I look forward to seeing you. And again, anyone out there have some great new things, we are open for business at the Air Force Research Laboratory.
Fantastic. Well, we'll make sure they have a way to connect to you. But again, thanks so much for your time.
Awesome. Thanks so much. Bye, Billy.
You can learn more about artificial intelligence at thedailyscooppodcast.com. The Daily Scoop podcast is available on all podcast platforms. If you've already rated the podcast on your platform of choice, thanks so much. High ratings and good reviews of the show help more people to find it. The Daily Scoop podcast is a production of the Scoop News Group in Washington, D.C. Adam Butler and Carlin Fisher help put the show together, and the entire Scoop News Group team contributes. We'll be back next week with brand new episodes. Until then, I'm your host, Billy Mitchell. Thanks so much for listening.